Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Stay-at-home orders across the country have many Americans spending more time with their favorite alcoholic libation. COVID-19 drinking memes are popular, quarantini recipes can be fun, and video chat happy hours are becoming a new norm. Ohio has followed suit. After the state health director ordered restaurants and bars closed, Ohioans bought more liquor in March than during any previous March on record. But the heavier drinking may lead to struggles that could outlast the pandemic. Julia Chester is a professor of psychological sciences at Purdue University, where she studies factors that influence alcohol and substance abuse disorders. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What is the psychological motivation that led so many people to stock up on booze?
Well, you know, it could be just that it's a similar type of motivation for what was causing people to stock up on toilet paper and other items that are difficult to come by in the grocery store these days, which is, you know, this unprecedented situation. People are going to be at home and they want to stock their shelves. Now, with respect to alcohol, the concern is that, you know, people are choosing to stock up on alcohol because this is something that is comforting to them and will help them deal with this stressor that we're all going through.
What has history taught us about these major global kinds of stressors or national stressors and how we consume alcohol?
Right. So in history, every time we have a national disaster or international disaster, or natural disaster like Hurricane Katrina or 9/11, scientists have been studying the alcohol drinking patterns of people after these events, and it always goes up. Now, it goes up in different ways in different populations of people. People who are closer to 9/11, you know, New York City, and people who worked in that area, frontline workers, first responders, were more affected than other people in the nation. But these are the types of events that typically result, we can see an increase in drinking over time. And many people start to develop alcohol use disorders over time as well.
Alcohol use disorders, did you say?
Yes.
Like what?
Well, an alcohol use disorder is basically defined as a problem with someone being able to control their drinking, and it's defined as something that is affecting the individual's life in a variety of ways. You can have mild, moderate, and severe disorder. So this is a new distinction that has been made by the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, where this alcohol use disorders are actually on a spectrum. And so really the defining characteristic of having a disorder is the fact that it's interfering with your daily life and your ability to consume alcohol in a healthy way. So the recommended amount of alcohol to a range to stay within in terms of consuming in a healthy way is about one drink per day for a woman, two for a man. If you find that you're exceeding that amount over time, you know, and start to escalate, this could indicate the starting of a disorder.
Why do people experience alcohol so differently? Do we know much about that?
Yes, we do. So, I mean, there's genetic differences in our response to alcohol. So, you know, people who have different genes, they have different environmental experiences, they have different life experiences, and our culture is different in different parts of the world surrounding alcohol. And so all of these things combine to create individual differences in risk and resilience with respect to alcohol. For people who have genetic predispositions, times of stress may be particularly problematic for them. Individuals who have mental health conditions, depression or anxiety, that are struggling now, stress is possibly a trigger, and substances are used, frequently alcohol is used to cope with stress and anxiety.
I would imagine that in states where marijuana is legal as a recreational, is recreationally illegal, that we'll probably see increases in that as well?
Yes. Yes.
Does the response to marijuana, do we know enough about it yet to know whether it has the same sort of long-term issues, when there's an uptick in use when it's stress-related?
We know much less about marijuana. And now that we have, states that are legalizing marijuana across the country, this will be, something that we will learn a lot more about in the coming times. There's similar effects. We do know quite a bit about marijuana, at this stage. Scientists have been studying it for a long time, and there's certainly, it's one of the substances that people use to cope with mental health issues and stress-related disorders, like PTSD, like depression, like anxiety. And so, but in terms of the molecular effects in the brain, there's differences between alcohol and marijuana. But some of the concerns with marijuana are similar to alcohol, such that you'll have long-term cognitive deficits that can occur. You can have motivational issues. It can actually trigger the onset of a mental health condition and exacerbate anxiety disorders. And so these substances really are not very good pharmaceutical tools to help us. They help very short-term, but in the long-term, they actually make problems worse.
Can people be using alcohol to cope with stress and not realize that's why they're drinking? Do you notice that?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I think awareness is a really important part of this story because, oftentimes we do things in ways that we don't realize why we're doing it. So individuals may... it's common for people to use alcohol. Because it's so accepted in our culture, and you started, the story started talking about how we have, cocktails and all these ways to deal with the pandemic. And it's very much associated in our culture with comfort, celebration, good times, socializing. And so when you start by using alcohol in the normal way that you may normally consume it for relaxation and comfort. But during this time, we have a lot of different aspects of our environment that are very stressful to us. We don't have a common, regular schedule that we're following in our day. And so for some individuals, it may be that they start to escalate their drinking in ways that they don't realize.
What should people be watching out for? Is it just the number of drinks, or are there other clues that there's an issue?
Right. So number of drinks is one metric to watch, but there are others as well. So if you find that, you are looking forward to consuming alcohol and you're thinking about it a lot during the day and waiting for that time when you can start consuming, that might be a problem. If you find that once you start consuming, you're having difficulty stopping your drinking, that might be a problem. If you're thinking about, how you're going to make the drink and when you're going to make it and when am I going to buy it again? Those are all sorts of cognitive thinking signs that maybe you are developing a problem with the alcohol, that it's that you're relying on it too much and that it could lead to escalated drinking.
And any advice for people on how they can achieve the same sort of goal of relaxation and kicking back without a drink?
Absolutely. So one of the best things that can help relieve our anxiety is exercise. And even if you can get in 10 minutes of walking, and even if it's around your house, I've been going up and down the stairs as much as I can. getting that heart rate up, even for a couple minutes, can relieve a little bit of the stress. In fact, there's a biological basis for this. You can actually have a release of endogenous endorphins, which is the same thing that alcohol causes, and to produce pleasure. So that is something we can do. And, you know, putting structure around your day is a really important part of coping with the stress as well. And reaching out to friends is really important. So social support is really important and can provide a lot of the same stress buffering effects.
As long as it doesn't revolve around quarantinis. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So being aware of that.
And, you know, what about people if they are having a problem? I mean, I know people who are doing online groups, you know, meetings and that kind of a thing with people that maybe they ordinarily would be at an AA or NA meeting for, you know, should you maybe is it time to get a counselor, a therapist,
yeah,
that kind of a thing?
Absolutely. So I'm glad you raised that. So the silver lining to this pandemic is that there have been a lot of resources that have opened up for individuals that might not normally have them or might not normally think that they even need to access them. So for some individuals, you know, getting at the issue early is really important. And you may not even know if you have a problem. You may not think you have a problem, but maybe you're concerned. Maybe you just want to check out, is my drinking a problem? So one of the, there's a number of websites that you can go to find resources to help inform you about your own drinking patterns and to also find social support groups, telehealth, and these are all free. So that's the wonderful thing. So one of the sources is the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, and they have a treatment navigator website there, and you can go there to find other self or group support groups and professional resources in your area. Mental Health America is a great resource as well. They have screening tools and telehealth resources, and Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration is also a wonderful resource.
We'll try to get those links on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Julia Chester, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Julia Chester is a professor of psychological service sciences at Purdue University. She studies factors that influence alcohol and substance abuse disorders. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Many older adults and others with medical conditions that make them more vulnerable are strictly abiding by stay-at-home orders to avoid catching COVID-19. And for them, the Meals on Wheels program is essential. Charles Gearing is President and Chief Executive Officer of Life Care Alliance, which provides Meals on Wheels in Franklin, Madison, Marion, Logan, and Champaign counties. Welcome to the show, Chuck Gearing.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Let's do a before and after shot of what you're doing right now. Has, for instance, has the number of clients that you serve through Meals on Wheels, has it changed since the pandemic took hold?
Oh, yes. Okay. We are actually today, we are doing 53% more Meals on Wheels than we were doing on March 1st. And I would tell you, before coronavirus occurred, we were pretty much the only group in the top 50 population centers nationally taking clients without waiting lists. Everybody else had a waiting list because of money and ability to take the meals out and things like that. And we were taking people. Well, we continue to take people. We're up 53%. We're about 2,300 people. And so it's been a little wild.
And is there still no waiting list?
There's still no waiting list with us.
One of our
things here that's just a mandated situation is we're going to take you if you qualify. And I think during this time, Ann, it's just even more critical than ever we take these people if they got to qualify. You know, you can be 85 years old and have lots of money and be able to drive and go to, you know, run around and you don't need us. But I would tell you, the people we've gained were people that we gained about 800 of those folks from dining centers and our dining centers and other people's dining centers and counties and the senior centers closing with the restaurant closure. And then secondly, the big thing the people are telling us is, hey, I have a family member who used to come in every third Saturday and take me to the shopping center and grocery stores, and that isn't happening anymore. And then secondly, the other thing they're saying to us is, you know, I'm just afraid to go to the store. If I get this, I could die. And we're getting a lot of that. And these are not a very, you know, they're a little more agile than some of our folks. But these were folks basically that had other supports from family members, things like that, and now just don't have them anymore because of the situation. You got to stay apart. So that's who we're getting, and it's going wild.
What's the typical service that you provide to that? Is it 2,300 people now total?
Oh no, that's new people.
That's what I thought. Okay, I just had to adjust my thinking there. What's your total number that you serve first?
Oh, we're past 5,000.
Okay,
we are probably the largest. There's bad stats on this because we're all local and we report to local boards, but. We're probably the largest charity organization in the country as far as number of meals. So,
wow! And what's a typical
we're consolidated
service
here?
Right, you serve several counties. What? So, is it three meals a day? Is it two meals a day? Is it?
No.
How does it work?
Well, it depends on what you need. There's never three meals. It's one or two meals a day. The basic is generally one meal a day. Which is, if you use the term meals on wheels, that means you're using federal guidelines as to how you make the meals, and it's one third of your daily nutrition. But I can tell you, if you eat our meal as a senior and have a couple of other smaller things, you're in fabulous shape. If you have no supports or you really struggle to get out, you can qualify for a second meal. So when we deliver the first meal hot at lunchtime, people out delivering right now, we then put a deli-style second meal in your fridge, and all you have to do at night is take that out and eat it. Because many of our folks, we don't want them having to try to heat these meals up.
Okay.
Now, with some of the new people, if you can handle this and you're a little more able to take care of it, we can provide frozen meals, which are we deliver a week's worth of meals to you at one time, load up your freezer, and off you go. I'm not a big frozen meal fan because of the fact that it eliminates that daily drop-off that we do to make sure you're okay. You know, only half the service is the meal. The other half is we're checking on you. We had a couple weeks ago, we found five people on the floor in a week. And now we have a lot of clients comparatively, but sometimes, and they were okay. Only one went to the hospital, but you know, people sometimes have trouble rocking themselves back up.
Yep.
If they do go down or something like that, or they've just had a bad day or they're not feeling well. So that daily service of going in and saying, hey, how you doing? And we've implemented procedures, Ann, that we had developed a decade ago for a possible pandemic, which we worked on with others in the Central Ohio area. So we have safe ways to deliver the meal to you. So one way we can do it is actually place it on your porch and then call you and go back kind of down the sidewalk and wait for you to come out and get your meal, and we check on you. But we can be 20 feet apart at that point. And but we are still – people are still going into homes because we have a lot of people who are bedridden.
Right.
In wheelchairs. et cetera, et cetera. And just to finish this point, I'll be quiet, is that the subject of the frozen meals, which I don't like as much, but they're okay for people. Some people do not have a microwave oven they can use.
Uh-huh.
Two parts of that sentence: don't have a microwave oven or can't use it. And secondly, one of the things you do with an early stage dementia person is you unplug the gas stove, right?
Right.
And it's and sometimes too, the third thing is we've got people on walkers and wheelchairs that for them to, you know, trying to heat this stuff up, it's a danger to some extent because they'll stick it in their oven or something and then fall asleep.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a good thing. And so we like the fact that the hot meal comes and goes from there, and so that's why we do what we do.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about Meals on Wheels today. It's become very important to a lot of people, as my guest, Chuck Gehring, President and Chief Executive Officer of Life Care Alliance, which provides Meals on Wheels to, Franklin, Madison, Marion, Logan, and Champaign counties. Did I get them all right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, plus, yes. Those are where we're the primary provider, the only provider generally. And then also in some of the other counties around Central Ohio, we're a passport provider, which is a state program where we'll go into those counties to assist. Because sometimes those providers are smaller and they can't get to everybody, you know.
Anyways, as Chuck just said, they have 2,300 new people, 53% more Meals on Wheels than on March 1st before the pandemic gripped us. If you have a question or comment about Meals on Wheels, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So for people who are going into the homes, are they, you know, they have masks, they're sometimes they have to go into the kitchens and put them in the refrigerator, right?
Right. And for those who are, bed-bound, wheelchair-bound, things like that, just can't get around. And we have educated them to be very safe. We've gotten a lot of new volunteers. I got to tell you, we've had since this thing broke, we've got 1,200 people that have signed up to be volunteers.
Wow, that's fantastic. I mean, did you have a downturn before you had the upturn?
No, we had, it's just been an upturn. We have about 7,500 active volunteers in our database right now that might, some deliver 5 days a week, but most of them deliver 1 day a month, 1 day a quarter, something like that. And this was a huge upturn. A lot of them came from companies who sent them home, and they're working from home.
Oh.
And, you know, or college kids. We've had a lot of college kids show up that are home, and they want to help. It's just been real heartwarming. I got to tell you, it's been amazing. We have every day the State Highway Patrol has been coming and delivering meals for us. It's just been amazing, the outpouring of interest in this. And every time I seem to be on the radio or TV, 15 more people show up.
Right.
And we've been training them. And but when they go back to work, the big thing is we've been talking to them now, and we're really pushing now to say, hey, when you go back to work, which is going to start happening here, can you still, will your employer support you 1 day a month to go out and deliver for us? Because we're gonna still have these people to deliver to.
Yeah.
And we're not going to have, some of the volunteers are going to have to go away. So we still need more, et cetera, et cetera. And, but they have just been wonderful. They've done anything we need. We have a very cancer-specific pantry. And as you know, Ann, cancer clients going through treatments are the last group you want to have out of a house right now. And we're feeding the whole family. So this involves taking 4 or 5 boxes of food to their house. We do that. And the other thing we do, which is a whole different group of volunteers, is pet food. And we're one of the few, very few major cities in the country who are doing pet food and have been doing pet food for about 12 years now.
Wow.
And we get it donated and by some big box retailers, especially Walmart. Walmart has been wonderful through this thing. It's a huge thing to them. They used to throw some of this stuff away, and now they give it to us. We rebag it, and it gets out to the clients so that they can keep that pet. The pet is often their family.
Yeah.
And the only, 70% of our clients tell us that they see no other adult on a regular weekly basis other than our worker, and which could be the volunteer. And so that pet, that dog or cat, is everything to them. So we take pet food and actually provide a little bit of veterinary care for them. Believe it or not, we'll pay for a little bit of vet care for these animals so they can keep their animal. And that's very important. So we're delivering that too. So we are the delivery kings of Central Ohio, and we've got a, there's cars, vans running around constantly, and we've got to get the stuff out. And what a lot of people don't know is that you don't come to our building. We have the meals all go out of a building on Harmon Avenue on the west side, about a half mile from old Cooper Stadium where the Clippers used to play.
Yep.
And but you don't come there. If you're in, let's say you're in Dublin today and you're going to do a route in Dublin, there is a, you're pre-trained and a van, and you know to show up in a church parking lot or something like that, a company parking lot at a certain specific time. Here comes a van, might have 7-8 routes on them. They hand you your bags. They hand you your route sheet. Off you go. You drive around Dublin and drop your bags back off when you're done. It's all done at lunchtime because that's best for digestion, and it's light out in December at lunchtime,
Yeah.
And
that's right.
Where it's not light out at dinner time
in
December.
Right.
And in Columbus, Ohio. And so you never leave that area where you're delivering. So people don't go that far. They take kids with them. They're, whatever. It's a great thing to do right now as a when you're stuck at home if you want to try it. And we always need more volunteers. And when this breaks, we're going to need more because people are going to go back to work.
Yeah, so don't be shy. Chuck, no. I know I talked to you years ago when I was a columnist for the Dispatch. How long have you been doing this?
I've been here. I've been in this job for 19 years almost.
Wow.
I'm not as young. I'm still only 29 years old.
You haven't aged a day in my mind. What about, do people pay for this or is it all free or how does that work?
It depends on the funder who's paying us back for the meal. If we have a funder, a lot of times it's fundraised dollars that pay for this, but if it's a funder, it can vary. There are scales and things, but the vast majority of our people pay nothing. If you are very wealthy, we would certainly ask you to assist. And with some funders, we're able to give you a contribution envelope should you wish to do it. But there's no, we don't push you on that. I mean, we get, literally hand you an envelope and say, if you want to contribute, send some.
Yeah.
And those people are sending a dollar type of thing once in a while.
Yeah.
The vast majority of our, anybody can have our service. It's not based on income level, but it's based on whether you can take care of yourself and whether you can cook for yourself.
Okay.
So we're assessing you based on how can you take care of yourself. And so the vast, vast, vast majority of our folks pay nothing.
And tell us, what's the lunch like? That's the big hot meal of the day, right?
Right. It's fabulous. There are, every day is different. We literally have 45 different entrees and multiple drinks and things like that. So it's not a lunch, it's a dinner, because lunchtime's your best time. Even young people like you and me, Ann, should eat our big meal at lunch because it's better for our digestion system.
Yep.
And but it's we've got all the favorites, like meatloaf and Salisbury steak have been 1-2 for years. But a recent addition that's shot up to number one, like American Top 40, is an omelet. We have an omelet.
Really?
We have breakfast foods. We have, yeah, and we also have, which most, this is a real oddity, most meals groups in the country have one meal. Here it is. That's all you can do.
Uh-huh.
If we have pork or fish on the menu, you can always alternate out of it. So if you never want to see pork or fish, you never have to see it. Or you can see it all the time. We have a number of people that opt into fish every Friday in Lent, which we just got through. We also have vegetarian. We have kosher. We have mechanical soft and pureed. Pureed's the consistency of baby food. Mechanical soft is chopped very finely for somebody with swallowing problems, no teeth, stomach problems, things like that. So we have alternatives for you. But all the meals are controlled in fat, sodium, and sugar content, so they're very healthy. And if you're a hospital person coming out of a hospital, where we get a number of new clients from, We find that after 90 days on our meal, you improve by about 30%. So sometimes you don't need us anymore. And they're very delicious. We've got all kinds of stuff. We've got these waffle sticks now with blueberry compote. out there. We got popcorn chicken. We try to stay up with the times and give you something that you want. And again, if you're hot, that's what comes. But frozen, if you're frozen meal, literally you get a menu and you pick what you want.
Wow.
And if you need our dietitian here, mm-hmm. or one of our dietitians, to talk to your physician, which happens often, especially with cancer patients and things like that, we do that. And all I can tell you, in my 19 years, we've never met a doctor we couldn't satisfy with one of our meal options.
Sounds astounding.
The second meal is a deli style, so it's a sandwich with sides, but it has sides, there's desserts, there's fresh fruits, there's a drink. You get, it's a lot of food, and because you're supposed to be eating it and things like that. And again, the reason we do pet food is not only is the pet their family member, but we found over the years a lot of people, and nationally this is the case, people were given part of their meals on wheels to their pet. And the person needs to be eating everything we give them, and frankly, cats shouldn't be eating Salisbury steak.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, it's not a good thing
for them. It's a lose-lose kind of a situation.
So that's why we do the pet food thing for 1,000 people, and so we go from there.
I understand you just received part of a $1 million donation from Battelle. What does that mean?
Yeah, we got $250,000.
Yeah. What was that? And was that special?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it makes me verklempt. It's incredible.
That's saying Chuck.
Battelle is one of many. The Columbus Foundation, Huntington Bank just committed, the City of Columbus, County of Franklin, et cetera, and a number of other companies, and I'm going to miss some of them, so I don't want to say them all. But a lot of the foundations and stuff have developed these emergency funds, and they have helped us. We just couldn't have taken on these new meals.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't have that kind of money. And we are a large agency, but a not-for-profit. And with their help, we've been able to cover some of these things. Because, you know, the SBA CARES loans are for payroll, basically, to pay the people who are getting all these meals together every day and things like that. But these other gifts, like from Battelle and all the other folks I mentioned and many others, have just been heaven sent. And I would tell you that they've allowed us to accept all these people and still take the clients when they call. And we were still taking 50 a day new people for a while, and now we're still at over 30 a day. And they keep
new
coming.
New clients.
Yeah. And again, in most cities in this country, the answer is, I'd love to help you, but I can't because I just don't have the capacity and I don't have the money. Yeah. So, you know, this community has always been very generous and gets together and says, we got to help out. Doug Kreidler, who runs the Columbus Foundation, called me early on in this, and he says, we sat here and said, Garrett, you guys are the ones, the Life Care Alliance, that have the target population,
right, the
seniors and medically challenged. So they've been very helpful to us, and we're rocking and rolling. I can't tell you that's going to be the case in September or August, depending on what happens with this thing. But we hope that we're thrilled the governor is opening up a little bit. And hopefully it'll get going away a little
bit. But that target population is going to be the last to get out. And I'm wondering, you know, what your pandemic plan looks like going forward.
Yeah. Oh, it's heavy. And, you know, our clientele are the last people on this earth that are going to get this virus because they don't leave their houses.
Yeah.
The only way they're going to get the virus is if our worker goes in and gives it to them. So we've got to very much, we are very close to our workers, and we got a lot of volunteers running around, but we tell them very, solidly that if you feel any weirdness in your body, you don't go. And people have been wonderful about this. I mean, we've had people, I had some drivers take themselves out at the beginning we have paid drivers too to supplement the volunteers. We never have enough volunteers. And we're the last group in the state, just so you know, delivering weekends and holidays. So we go 7 days a week, 365 a year. Nobody else in the state does that anymore because of, again, money. and just trying to find volunteers and things. And because we've been able to find volunteers over the years, we still run on weekends and holidays. And but it's we tell everybody that, look, you got to be very strict with this. We've got rules. We do have a pandemic plan that was developed, like I said, years ago. We watch over it very carefully, and knock on wood, we haven't had a problem yet. And, you know, we had a couple workers that felt funny that had something, and we said, you don't come in, you stay at home, and they have, and then they go to a doctor, and the doctor checks them out and gets back. You know, the early ones didn't have tests. You know, there weren't tests available even. So we just said, you stay home and call us in 2 weeks and let us know how you know, right. And we check on them and stuff. That's an exaggeration. But, you know, we're trying to keep people healthy, and we're trying to be adamant with them. We mandate masks, that you're wearing masks. We've got people socially distant. We got a lot of people out of here. If you're an office worker, you're not here.
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera. And we're trying to be as careful as we can to watch ourselves and just keep it
keep it going,
because we got to keep it going. So, but we'll continue, and we're in a lot of wipes everywhere.
I hear you.
A lot of masks, a lot of wipes, and a lot of masks.
I imagine that you've always done a great job, Chuck Gehring. It's just been a delight talking to you. Thank you so much for doing what you do, and to all your people there who are helping out, and all the volunteers and workers. It's such an important part of how we keep going during this pandemic. So thank you.
Thank you.
That's Chuck Gehring. He's president and chief executive officer of Life Care Alliance. We'll have a link to the agency on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. They are the ones that bring the Wheels on Meals to people throughout Central Ohio. So if you're interested in that, you can give them a call. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Until a vaccine is developed, plasma is among the best hope for an effective COVID-19 treatment. The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center earlier in April transfused the first patient in central and northern Ohio with plasma from a recovered COVID-19 patient. Dr. Howard Wehrman is an emergency physician at the Wexner Medical Center and is the first donor of convalescent plasma there. Welcome to the show, Dr. Wehrman.
Thank you.
And Dr. Scott Scrape is a pathologist and director of transfusion medicine at Wexner Medical Center. Welcome to the show, Dr. Scrape.
Hi, thank you.
All right, so the Food and Drug Administration put out a memo 2 weeks ago encouraging recovered COVID-19 patients to donate plasma for the development of blood-related therapies. How does this, they're calling it convalescent plasma therapy. How does it work, Dr. Scrape?
So we take plasma from donors who have recovered from COVID-19 and process it and give it to patients that are still in the hospital that are still recovering from the disease.
Could it be somebody who was asymptomatic?
There is a certain level of antibodies that we're shooting for in order to make the product therapeutic. And what we found is that the more severe the disease for the donor, the higher their level of antibodies. So asymptomatic patients, what we have found is they typically don't have the level of antibodies that we need for plasma to be used as therapy.
And Dr. Wehrman, you were the first donor?
I was. I was contacted. I had a positive test on March 20th, but had a relatively mild case, actually. I was pretty lucky in that regard. Then I guess I was contacted by somebody probably about 3 weeks ago asking if I'd be willing to donate plasma. And again, I felt, you know, obviously that it was really my obligation to do that. So I did. Again, I had a mild case, and I think Scott can probably talk a little bit more about the kind of the titers that were found.
What does that mean, Dr. Scrape?
Well, that's the level of antibodies that I was referring to a little earlier.
Uh-huh. And so there's it's a continuum then. Someone who's asymptomatic isn't going to be able to do it, but someone at the point that how Dr. Wehrman was sick, that did help.
Yes, absolutely.
Why isn't this just it's a therapy? It's not a cure, right?
Right, right. It's a boost to the patient's immune system that helps them in their antibody. They're already trying to make antibodies, and we're giving them passively antibodies that were made by someone else to boost their immune system.
And do they have to be the same blood type, or is that involved in all of this as well?
They do need to be the same blood type, yes.
Okay. And if you, what's the donation process? How are you reaching out to people besides this way?
Well, on the main webpage for the Wexner Medical Center, we have a large banner that says COVID-19 across the front of the page. Once you click on that, you come to our Med Center COVID-19 page, and then there's a box that says Ways to Help. And in that box, you can go to the screening page to see if you're qualified to donate plasma.
What has been the response so far?
It has been fantastic. We are just in our third week, and we have over 340 volunteers that would like to donate plasma. We have collected through this week, we've collected 40 products. Now, keep in mind that our first week was just Dr. Wehrman himself.
Uh-huh.
So we've come a long way in a very short period of time, collecting 40 products. We've used 15 of those products here at Wexner Medical Center, and we've shared 25 of those products with other hospitals in the Midwest.
Okay, you answered a question I was going to have, is can you do that like they share blood? And is it different collecting the plasma for this purpose than it is? I've never given plasma before, so I don't know how that works, but is it different?
It's not different. It's kind of like a regular blood donation. When a person donates a unit of blood,
uh-huh.
It's very similar to that. And the process takes about an hour. And one donation, a single person can donate enough to help three patients in the hospital.
Are certain blood types in need? Are you in need of certain blood types more than others?
With this product, we are in need of all blood types.
Dr. Wehrman, you had a mild case of COVID-19. What was that like?
I did. I've been traveling back and forth, back down to Florida. My mother was ill, and then I had to go back up to New York. And basically, I came back and had sort of an upper respiratory infection, which kind of settled into a sore throat. I've been doing a lot of traveling, so I had some fatigue and some literally minor body aches, not what I've heard other folks complain about.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, was I not a healthcare worker, I would not even have been tested. I wouldn't even have sought testing.
Uh-huh.
But in my particular case, I had, in the early spring, early fall, I actually came down with a case of influenza B, and it was so early that I didn't even realize what it was.
Uh-huh.
So I ended up at work a couple times, and I did not want to repeat that. So,
yeah, right.
Yeah. By the way, I want to add one point, which I think sometimes, because I think people are incredibly well-meaning and want to donate, but one of the things you absolutely have to have for the plasma donation is a documented COVID-19 test, a positive test. And I've personally, from friends and people, very well-meaning people, had an illness. People call and say, I've had an illness, and I think it could have been COVID.
Yeah.
And I want to donate. And right now, the way the program is set up, those people would not be eligible.
And Dr. Scrape, you're not going to also do the tests to figure out if they did get COVID. It's got to already be done.
That's right. That's right. The population that we're looking at are people who have had the positive test, like Dr. Wehrman just mentioned, mm-hmm. and then have been symptom-free for at least 28 days.
Okay.
that would qualify a person to be a donor.
What do we know about the success you've had treating patients at the Wexner Medical Center so far in this way?
Well, this has been given under a compassionate care investigational new drug protocol.
And what does that mean?
What it means is it's being given to the very sickest of patients that we have here. So we have seen some successes, and we have seen some patients who have continued to have a poor prognosis because we're giving it so late in their disease cycle. What we are opening up an expanded access program just this week where we can give this to people who are not necessarily in the intensive care unit, who may be on the floor and may be deteriorating and heading toward the intensive care unit. It looks like they may head there, but they're not there yet. And we would like to expand the access, and we're going to do that this week, so that those patients can take advantage of this and perhaps have a turn of events and not end up in the ICU.
So you're kind of looking for a sweet spot overall.
Yep.
When's the best time? And also, how do you decide who does get it in that expanded access program?
Well, like you say, with any therapy, it's better to give it early.
Yeah.
And to get the most benefit out of it. Anybody with COVID-19 that's in our hospital that is symptomatic, we would like to try this on at some level.
And so people should just reach out to you and let you know if they're available to give. Are people asking for it?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Right. Yes, they are.
They're asking to get this therapy.
Yes. That's why we have shared this with many hospitals across the Midwest that don't have the facilities that we have to collect this and the processing facilities that we have through our blood blood partner. Versity Blood Center of Milwaukee is partnering with us. And so with them on board, we have fantastic resources to collect here at the Wexner Medical Center, process the plasma, and get it into a patient fairly quickly within 48 hours.
And how do you administer the therapy?
It's just like any unit of plasma.
Okay.
So it's just hung at the bedside and ran over up to 4 hours, and so it's like any other unit.
Are there any risks?
This is a very safe product. So the donors have to meet the same criteria as a regular blood donation, like you would walk in and donate a unit of red cells.
Uh-huh.
So it's a very safe product.
This is a little off topic, and we're running out of time, but I wanted to, are blood donations keeping pace with the pandemic, amid the pandemic?
Yes, they certainly are. So we were expecting some sort of shortage going into the pandemic. But in fact, the blood donors are so dedicated, especially here in Ohio, that they just came out of the woodwork, and we were abundantly supplied with blood.
Will it help when the antibody test gets going so you can find more donors?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that will help.
Okay. Well, Dr. Howard Wehrman, the first donor of therapeutic plasma, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thanks a lot for having me.
Dr. Howard Wehrman is an emergency medicine physician at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center, where Dr. Scott Scrape is a pathologist and director of transfusion medicine. Thank you, Dr. Scrape, for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.